supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
Hi, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Although not unique to humans, grief is a process that reminds us all of our common root in mortality. When our loved ones die, we think, how will we manage without them? How can life go on? We question whether we will be able to make it and wonder, if we are, how will we do it? What will that look like? Throughout the last century, psychologists, psychiatrists have theorized that people grieve in very distinct ways. Freud called it the work of grief, or Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who we all know, talked about the five stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and, of course, acceptance. But as we'll discuss in the show, it turns out this is not necessarily the case. After numerous interviews and studies, our guest, George Bonanno, has found that not only do we not grieve in the same way, but in general, we don't grieve as long or as hard as previously thought. In fact, we are quite resilient. So George Bonanno joins us by phone. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Counseling and Clinical Psychology at Teachers College at Columbia. He's the author of The Other Side of Sadness, What the New Science of Bereavement Tells Us About Life After Loss. George, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Very nice to talk with you.
And I'm joined here in the studio by Barbara Davis. She's a social worker with 35 years of hospice experience. And she's currently with Jefferson University, and she's also got a private practice locally here. Barbara, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. If you are currently grieving or have recently lost a loved one or had in the past, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, George, when I was in graduate school, this is in the late 60s, things were pretty simple. There were five stages of grief. Well, later we got more sophisticated and realized these stages weren't necessarily linear. We didn't go from one to the other. And later, we got even more sophisticated and realized that that word she used, acceptance, was really kind of misused. There wasn't an end process called acceptance. So it seemed like we were getting more sophisticated in our thinking over the decades. So what was it that got you that started wondering that maybe all this is all wrong from the beginning?
Well, I had kind of come at the whole question somewhat through the side door. I guess that'd be the best way to talk about it. I really didn't know much about the bereavement literature. I was trained as a clinical psychologist at Yale, but my training was really more heavily couched in the basic sciences and in experimental psychological research. And it was really quite serendipitous that I ended up studying bereavement at all. I had decided upon graduating that I kind of wanted to change gears a little bit and shift my career back toward more of the clinical questions that I was interested in. And I was not sure exactly what or how that would manifest. And then I was offered a position doing bereavement research out in San Francisco. And it was a very nice position heading up a big project. But as I said, I knew very little about the topic at all. And when I began to look at the literature, coming from really this side door, immediately it struck me that this, it really didn't make much sense. These increasingly sophisticated ideas that you mentioned really didn't seem to jibe with everything else I knew about psychology.
Well, why? What do you mean?
Well, the emphasis has been on this elaborate process of working through and untangling and unpacking all the complex reactions we have to loss, and the stages and the sense of slogging through this elaborate, effortful process, the work of mourning.
Doesn't that fit with everything we did know about psychology and psychotherapy? I mean, what Freud said.
Well, it may have seemed to have fit with psychotherapy, but the fact psychotherapy is really for people who are having difficulties, and a lot of the literature on loss, I'd say most of it had come from the therapy domain. So therapists are writing about their patients, or psychiatrists who work primarily with people with disorders were writing about those experiences. And it did make more sense, although I'm still not convinced it makes sense even in that domain, as I can explain later, but that's really the experience that people are focusing on, the experience of extreme pain. And in fact, when we began to do the research and look at just the broad swatches of people, the full range of people, we saw nothing like that kind of pain.
Hmm. You've said that we experience actually positive emotions throughout all these so-called stages of grief. You know, traditional psychology might call that denial.
Absolutely.
You found it was the opposite.
Yeah, in fact, when we began to look at these at bereavement, and we began to look at emotions, and we did measure positive emotions right off the bat, and we found, as you had mentioned, that most people are capable of experiencing genuine positive emotions, even early on after a loss, and even when they're in great pain.
So what do you mean? I mean, give us an example of a positive emotion.
Well, let me back up a little bit and just say a few things about emotion, because I think there are features of emotion that are simply not well understood, and that emotions are not... emotions are very ephemeral things, and we are wired, our evolutionary heritage or the equipment we come with into life is to have these very brief and very powerful emotional experiences. They're adaptive, and they get us through tough times. These emotions we have are designed to help us deal with really difficult situations, but they're fast and quick. They're ephemeral, and we may experience them repeatedly. So if we think of sadness... sadness is the dominant emotion we think of when we talk about loss, but when a person feels intense grief, they're not sad from beginning to end for 3 weeks or 3 months.
Although they might experience themselves that way,
they may experience themselves that way or think of themselves that way. But right. that would exhaust us to be in a state of sadness constantly, say 18 hours a day for 3 weeks straight. We would be exhausted. So what really happens is that we have these episodes of sadness. They can lead anywhere from a few seconds to a few minutes to a few hours at the most. They're really never much longer than a few hours. And we'll have an episode of sadness, and then it will kind of alleviate. And our mood, our experience lightens up. We may not even be fully aware of this happening. And we can even, in those early weeks and days after a loss, we might even temporarily forget the loss even happened. And it's in that period of time that we also, when that lightening up period, that we also can experience positive emotions. We can share a laugh with somebody else. We can remember something pleasant.
Well, I also wonder about what positive emotions mean. I remember after my sister died, I think it was the day after her death, or several days, we were in Shiva, the traditional morning, and somebody came up to me and told me a story about her that I hadn't known, just a wonderful story about her generosity and her humanity, and I heard it, and I wept, and, you know, it looked sad, and I guess I would label it sad, but it was so much more than that. It had so much more, that emotion had so much more texture than just simple sadness. I would almost label it a positive emotion, yeah. a positive kind of sadness.
I think absolutely, and sadness can be beautiful also. I mean, in the psychological experiments that are designed to evoke sadness, we sometimes want to make people sad so we can study that. We use Mahler and other things, you know, and so people willfully go to hear Mahler. Not everybody, but people willfully go to hear Mahler because it's beautiful and sad. But the emotional reactions are incredibly multifaceted and complex, and they're blends of emotions, and as you described. But sometimes also, the laughter and the positive emotion are just simple positive emotion. And we look at this by coding people's facial expressions. We're very interested in doing this in the face because we can identify these states fairly unambiguously.
So this follows up on the work of Paul Ekman, who we had on the show fairly recently.
Absolutely, yes. In fact, early on in this research, when I was in San Francisco, it was Paul Ekman, Ekman's influence that was hovering over this entire project, because I began to work with Dacher Keltner, who was at the time a postdoctoral research fellow with Paul Ekman. And I spent probably as much time with Paul Ekman in those early days as I did with the other people I was working with on the bereavement project. So this was a heavy influence in the way we began to think about this. But we see people, you know, we have sometimes these very complicated memories and emotions that events that evoke multiple emotions, and you know, sadness mixed with you know, sweet and sorrow, sadness and sadness mixed with joy. But we also at times simply just kind of temporarily forget, and we laugh at a little thing somebody said. And by and large, most of the positive experiences people have are in interactions with others, and it does seem to be fairly clear that we're wired to do that. We're wired to interact with other people, and other people are wired to interact with us around these issues. One of the ways that I think it's very important to think about it is if you think about what emotions are things that we feel, but they're also shown in our face. And if we ponder that for a little bit, it becomes clear that it didn't have to be that way. Nature didn't have to design for us, or we didn't have to evolve facial expressions, but we did. And we do so because we communicate with each other with facial expressions. Mm. And they have their purposes. And sadness is quite remarkable in this regard, because when we're feeling sad, we're turned inward, we're looking inward, and we're taking stock of what's happening. Our heart rate tends to slow down. The world seems to go into slow motion. We really stop paying attention so much to the world around us.
Well, I want to add one other dimension to sadness, and then I want to go to the phones, because okay. We've got several callers who want to join us. I have a poem on my computer about emotions, about, you know, how competence tends to be off-putting to people, and when we deny our emotions, it creates distance. But this poem ends with a line, she says, and sadness, she says, sadness opens us up to one another. Mm. And you know, in a way it does have us looking inside, but when we express our sadness, share our sadness comfortably with others, it really does open up to more intimacy, to more contact, to more humanity.
Absolutely, and we are very much wired, I would argue, to feel that kind of connection. When we see another person looking sad, we feel sympathy, and yeah. That's actually a remarkable facet of human behavior.
Yeah, it's part of the good stuff.
We carry
around.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones. By the way, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about grief and mourning. We're talking about new research about grief and what we're learning about it. Some exciting stuff. Our number is 888-477-9499. Excuse me. Let's go to Bill.
Yo.
Bill, hi. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just wanted to, you know, mention I was listening to your thing here. And unfortunately, my wife passed away about a year ago, Christmas of 2008. And it was after a 5-year battle with cancer, and I have just been crippled by my grief and depression, I guess, and, you know, your idea of having anything sounding positive, I just don't see it at all. It's just like one big black world. I know that sounds awful negative, and I have talked with several counselors who say, oh, it's a grieving process, you'll get over it in your own time. Well, I'm, you know, thinking I've only got about 25 years or 30 years left, and I don't think I'm ever going to get over this, but, you know, your positive things, I really don't see where you come with that.
Well, let me ask Barbara Davis to weigh in on this. Barbara, I'd like to hear your thoughts for Bill.
Well, sounds like you are dealing with a fair degree of depression right now.
And yeah, they've told me it was the exact same thing as if I have post-traumatic stress syndrome, as if I had been fighting in a war for 5 years and lost it.
Who told you that?
Psychiatrist. Huh. Or a counselor, I guess he really was. I'm not sure if he was a full shrinker or not.
So you don't see an end to this, it sounds.
No, I was going to say, I mean, because it became so crippling, I actually lost my job. They couldn't, you know, I wasn't performing my job, so they laid me off about a month after my wife passed away. And, you know, like I said, my best thing is if I can get out of bed, I'm doing pretty good.
So let me ask you a question, Bill, and I ask this question a lot, and I get on a lot of people's nerves. So the question is, what do you want?
I'm not really sure. Like I said, some comfort somewhere of saying, you know, this does happen, or, you know, how you will pass. Everybody told me it'd take about a year.
No,
I'm sitting here looking around my bedroom now, and all my wife's stuff is still here. I tried to empty out one drawer and got so depressed
Bill,
I couldn't stand it.
Stick with me here.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want?
I'm not sure. I guess, you know, like I said, somebody told me it was a big mistake and this hasn't really happened. I don't think that's going to happen, is it?
No.
So.
All right, I'm going...
I don't know. I'm trying to look for somebody to tell me, hey, this will work, or this is what you need to do to get past this grief.
Well,
than telling me that, when people tell me, they know how they feel, how I feel.
I'm gonna come back to you. I'm going to annoy you. I'm sorry to annoy somebody who's already suffering. But so you say you want to get past it.
Try to, yes.
Wait. Mm-hmm. Do you want to get past it?
Yeah, because like I said, it's just, you know, like a big vice is on my heart.
Okay.
You know, the day Nancy died, the vice just collapsed on my heart like a cold vice, and just won't let go.
Let me stop you for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
When I asked you if you wanted to get past it, there was a moment of silence.
Mm-hmm.
Are you sure you want to get past it?
Well, I'm never ever going to forget about Nancy, no.
So what does getting past it look like? What's your vision?
I'd like to see, like I said, I'd like to go outside and see the sunshine and say, listen to the birds and say, hey, that's really nice, isn't it?
Have you?
And be able to drive in my car and not hear a song on the radio that makes me feel sad because of, you know, reminds me of everything we've done in the past.
Well, let me turn to you, George. If I may.
Of course.
It sounds like that perhaps some of this has happened and maybe Bill hasn't noticed. You know what I mean?
I don't know what you mean.
You have a positive experience, and then all of a sudden, you know, like I said, you can remember something good, then you remember, you know, almost immediately a flash after of, oh, gee, I remember that. That was a lot of fun. We all had fun together, and then you remember how your wife deteriorated, and I just can't get the visions out of the last 2 minutes of her life out of my head of watching her pass away. And it always seems to come back to that thought, and I can't get past that. So.
There is some research, George, and I know you're familiar with it, called PGD, Prolonged Grief Disorder.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is kind of, you know, what Bill said. It's kind of a grief version of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, we're beginning to try to understand that. Bill, your situation is not uncommon. It happens in maybe 10% of the people that we've seen who are bereaved. So that's a small percentage, but it is a lot of people. And I'm really sorry to hear about your pain, because I think it can be just the most wrenching kind of pain. So I'm sorry to hear that you're going through that. It must feel like if you do get better, you will lose your wife.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a wonderful little essay by C.S. Lewis, was a wonderful writer, who talked about the fact that when he finally began to get over his grief, it was only then that he began to get his wife back, because he could remember her again when he had lost her. Well, he had remembered her again when he finally stopped grieving as much, and that the grief was really keeping him from even remembering her.
Mm, that's very close to true, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like you said, you remember the good things, and then all of a sudden it just comes back. I cannot get the last, 2 years when she was so sick out of my head.
There are some new treatments that are being developed to help people who really get kind of stuck in the kind of pain that you're experiencing.
They did put me on antidepressants, but that took all emotion away from you. You know, nothing. You had no happiness, no sadness.
What are the new treatments coming?
Well, there's one treatment developed by Kathy Scheer, who's one of my colleagues at Columbia, and another by Paul Bolin in Holland. And one of the things they do a lot of different things. Sometimes they really just suggest that people just simply get out as much as they can and try to get themselves out in the world again and having positive experiences and having as much as of that as they can. They also ask people to look back on the loss, and they ask them to talk about it. It's a little bit like some of the treatments for post-traumatic stress disorder, not exactly the same. But the idea is that to somehow get people to talk about what it is they're holding on to with the loss. And I don't want to imply anything about you, Bill, because I don't really, I don't know enough about your life to make any kind of snap judgments like that. That would be careless on my part. But often in these treatments, they ask people to just talk about the loss and what happened and what it means to them. And often they find that people are sometimes holding on to an idea or a misconception or even an idea that would be better if they let it go, related to the loss. Somehow, and it sounds like in just a very brief time, again, I want to be very careful in making any kind of conclusions at all based on what you said, but I kind of heard a sense that if you get better, you might lose her. You might forget her.
That's a pretty universal fear, I think, and that's why people hold on to the grief and the suffering and the pain, because they are afraid they'll lose her. Bill, thanks so much for your call. I hope it was helpful.
No, I think so. Like I said, you spend 27 years or 26 years with a person almost on a daily basis, and Nancy was only 47 when she died.
Well, one of the things we're hearing is from George, and we've been hearing it on this show for a while from the neuroplasticity people. It's kind of AA saying fake it until you make it, and what that does is it starts to rewire your brain. So even if you don't feel like it, get out. Even if you don't feel like it, go to the park. Wake up early one day and watch a sunrise. Even if you don't feel like it. And even if you don't feel like it, smile at someone walking down the street. And these things will have an impact overall. And it will begin to change your perspective. I'm not saying that kind of simple approach is going to solve all the problems, but it is a way to begin. Well, we're going to have to take a short break now. We're talking about grief art. Phone lines are lit up, but if you want to be patient with us, you can call us at 888-477-9499. We're talking about actually new research on grief. We're with George Bonanno. He's a professor, chair of the Department of Counseling and Clinical Psychology at Teachers College at Columbia University. He is also author of The Other Side of Sadness, What the New Science of Bereavement Tells Us About Life After Loss. I'm also joined here in the studio by Barbara Davis, social worker who's got 35 years experience with hospice. She's currently with Jefferson University and has a private practice here in the Delaware Valley. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
The University of Pennsylvania Museum supports WHYY. Wednesday, March 17th at 6 p.m., the Penn Museum offers a conversation on urban poverty in Philadelphia and the United States. Philippe Bourgois, curator of Righteous Dope Fiend, Homelessness, Addiction, and Poverty in Urban America, leads the roundtable discussion with specialists Elijah Anderson, Eric Schneider, and Michael Katz. The exhibition is now on view. Details are online at www.penn.museum.
I'm Krista Tippett. Please join me on Tuesday, April 27th at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts. We'll explore Einstein's God and the fascinating interplay of questions, if not answers, that is emerging between 21st century science, medicine, theology, and philosophy. Call 215-893-1999 or visit whyy.org/member experience to get your tickets for this evening of ideas on April 27th. I'd love to see you there.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about new research about grief. We're with George Bonanno, professor, chair of the Department of Counseling and Clinical Psychology at Teachers College at Columbia. He's written The Other Side of Sadness, What the New Science of Bereavement Tells Us About Life After Loss. Barbara Davis joins me here in the studio. She's got 35 years experience in hospice work. She's with Jefferson University and has a private practice here in the Delaware Valley. George, one of the things you said in your book is that it's best to change things in the room after a loved one dies. I don't you think there should be a period of mourning, respect? I went to an extreme when my dad died. I went to his apartment, and I just had to have everything cleaned out and changed quickly. And I don't know. I felt some regret about that. I'd kind of like to see his old easy chair.
I would say that we wouldn't say that one should necessarily get rid of everything and clean everything out. The part of the book we were talking about those issues was really around the sense of how much you strive to maintain a connection with a person and how much that might or might not be healthy. Then there are certainly mementos and aspects of a person's life that we don't want to touch. I actually had my father's shoes for many, many years, literally his shoes, and actually wore them a while, maybe 10 years after his death. Mm. And that meant a great deal to me. And it, apart from the obvious metaphor of fitting into his shoes, but it was just meaningful. And I still have some of my father's objects. But really, it's one of the more curious and difficult to nail down aspects of what people do during bereavement is whether they hold on to possessions or not, or how much they keep a connection. People often talk to loved ones, and we're trying to understand that right now and how healthy that might be and how unhealthy it might be at times.
Do we know?
Well, we have some preliminary findings. I mean, the issue about the room was pretty clearly that there's nothing particularly wrong about leaving a person's belongings as they are. However, people can become kind of obsessive about it, where they want nothing removed, nothing touched, nothing changed, and it becomes a very serious matter. Then that starts to lean over or cross the line over into the domain that might not be so healthy. The notion of having an inner connection to someone is also a very curious thing, and we've seen many people who cope extremely well with loss who do report that they have the sense of connection to the person. They even experience at times almost hallucinatory interactions with the person, where they feel the person had visited them and was talking.
And what does the research show?
Well, the research is a little ambiguous. We're still trying to work it out. It seems to be that it's a matter of degree. And that in a very intense internal connection seems to be okay, but if it's extreme, it again can become problematic. The hallucinatory reactions do seem to get us into the realm of being problematic, the sense that the person's presence is everywhere. Because, one of the things we go through when a loved one dies is we have to really just face the reality that they're gone. And that is not always as easy as it might seem, because, we have a sense of a person's presence in our minds even when they're alive. When
yeah.
They're not with, most of the time, the people that we're closest to are not with us.
And I want to get to that. I want to get to issues of where our deceased loved ones are now for us. Barbara, I'd like to hear you weigh in on this about our experience of having our loved ones with us.
Well, I'm I'm being a little discomforted sitting here listening to this because I think, I guess my experience, both personally as well as professionally, in working with people who are experiencing loss, is that we can healthfully remain connected with the the person or the thing that we lost, without it being a pathological pathological reaction. I think that one of the goals of the grieving process is to, if we want to maintain a relationship with what was lost, and not have it create a block in our life that we can't get beyond. And the word hallucinatory I was also having a problem with, because I think, especially immediately after a death, maybe also after the loss of an appendage, that, a part of us gets it, that the person or the part of us is gone, but a part of us still talks about that, what was lost, in the present tense, or kind of quote forgets that she's gone or it's gone. I don't know. I feel that the word hallucinatory is another word that I don't know.
Let me come back to you, George, on this, and I don't want to spend too much time on it. But whether or not this is a problem, doesn't it depend on one's belief system?
It absolutely, and that's a really important part. Forgive me if the term hallucinatory is offensive. It's, I'm a research psychologist, so we throw these words around sometimes, but I think one's belief system, one's cultural background, all of those things are enormously important. We just did a study, we haven't published this data yet, but we just did a study comparing African Americans and white or Caucasian Americans in just those two groups, and we measured by a questionnaire, limited way to do it, these questions about hallucinatory experiences, or we didn't use the word actually hallucination, but the experiences were that we felt that the person was physically present and able to influence us. And for white people, this was problematic and predicted much more severe grief reactions. That wasn't the case for African Americans. Mm-hmm. We can't make any real strong conclusions about that yet, but we do see very clearly differences when we go outside the United States, where we see that in cultures where such practices and such ideas are more commonplace, that they're actually adaptive. The study we did in China showed that among the Chinese province of Nanjing, this was in the 1990s, that the more people had a sense of the felt presence of the deceased loved one, the healthier they were.
Well,
we didn't find that in the United States.
Speaking of cultures, I referred to Shiva, the Jewish ritual of mourning, and it's been around thousands of years, and asks us to spend a certain number of days just thinking about our departed loved ones. I mean, the Orthodox,
yes,
are supposed to cover the mirrors so they can't think about themselves and even sit in uncomfortable chairs. I remember my uncle walked to synagogue every morning with sand in his shoes. It was they were supposed to suffer. So how does that stand up to modern research?
Well, I don't know of any modern research about that particular issue, or about Shiva, actually, for that matter. There's been surprisingly little research on these questions. The entire issue of bereavement and research is a mystery, because it's been under-researched, for lack of a better word. So we don't know a lot of these things. We often have to rely on personal stories, which is complicated. I have a very close friend who lost her son, did Shiva for a week. The ceremony itself was wonderful, the experience, and she was devastated and took years and years to get over that loss. So whatever the bonus of the whatever the advantage of the ritual, it wasn't working for her. There's a lot of idiosyncrasy and individual factors that come into play in something this complicated.
George, you said it took years and years for her to get over the loss.
Yes.
What happened after years and years?
Well, the thing about prolonged grief reactions, and this is something similar probably that we could have talked to Bill about, who was on the show earlier, that there's a certain kind of natural course that grief runs, and for one reason or another, it doesn't always it doesn't end or doesn't run that course the way it does for most people, and becomes more and more drawn out. And when grief becomes more and more drawn out, there's the classic idea of the downward spiral, the internal looking inward to sadness, the reflection, and kind of trying to work out where the person had gone to and the fact that they are dead. That gives way over time. And naturally, it'll give way over time as we kind of move beyond that. But when it doesn't give way, it turns into something more difficult. It turns into rumination. It turns into kind of a state of being lost internally. And relationships begin to suffer. It's harder to go to work. And all those things then have their own consequences. When you have prolonged grief reactions, then you have really a very difficult situation.
Yeah, one of my experiences clinically, and I want to turn to you, Barbara, is prolonged grief reactions often turn into identity. I am. This is who I am and what I am now, which means, you know, moving beyond it now gets even more problematic.
Right.
Your thoughts about who's more likely to have these prolonged grief reactions and who's more likely to be resilient?
I don't think I have an idea of who is. I think there are so many factors that determine how we grieve, how long we grieve, what we grieve. I certainly Dr. Bonanno talked about his friend who lost a child. That's, I think, losing a child, I think, is a much more complicated grief journey than losing, as I did, a parent at age 90-something.
Right.
I think the preparation that we have for a person's death, if that's what we're talking about here, just deaths, how much time we have to prepare for it.
There are many, many factors. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Mark on the line. Hey, Mark. Mark. I guess we lost Mark. Yeah, we lost Mark. We'll go to Whitney. Hi, Whitney.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was a hospital chaplain for 9 years, and I'm 46 years old, so I know I have a long way to go, but and all of this is great conversation. I think people, in my experience, and I saw, everything from babies to elderly people die and under all certain circumstances. I was not a hospice chaplain. I was emergency trauma center chaplain, and I covered surgical trauma, various areas in the hospital. My experience with people, of course, is that everybody grieves differently. Not everybody grieves the same. The person showing the most grief may not be the one grieving the most. And I think, it would be nice to do more research on this, but I think so much of how we grieve in our lives is informed within our families, as well as our culture and as well as our religions. And ultimately, to me, all of that needs to be taken into account when people are grieving. And if the individual really chooses to, face the grief, experience the grief, and move on, as it were, more of society needs to be supportive of that. Most people said to me the comments that they disliked the most to hear was, oh, God needed another angel, or, oh, you'll get over it, or, well, at least this didn't happen. And maybe to understand grief more as we become better listeners and just help guide and ask open-ended questions and encourage the person that, if truly this is something you do want to find peace and, enjoyment in your life after someone has left this world.
I think that's great advice, Whitney, and I appreciate your calling in, and of course it fits with what George was saying, what we all know, that it's about relationships, it's about people being in our lives, and not people who are just trying to make us feel better, but people who love us enough to simply offer us companionship, and we know how healing that is. We've got to take a short break. There's many other topics I want to cover before we have to close the show. We're joined by Barbara Davis here in the studio. She's a licensed social worker. She's been doing hospice work for 35 years. She's currently with Jefferson University's Center in the Park, and she's also got a private practice here in the Delaware Valley. George Bonanno is on the phone with us from New York. He's a professor chair of the Department of Counseling and Clinical Psychology at Teachers College, and he's also the author of The Other Side of Sadness, What the New Science of Bereavement Tells Us About Life After Loss. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Support for WHYY is provided by Abington Memorial Hospital, now offering a new program for men with elevated PSAs who may be at risk for prostate cancer. The Prostate Evaluation Program brings together a multidisciplinary team of physicians and specialists who review cases together, providing recommendations and action steps for each individual. For more information, 215-481-MALE or AMH.org. Abington Memorial Hospital, the power to heal.
In Mexico, the drug war starts in the streets but often ends in the emergency room.
It's not secure anymore to work. It's a doctor here. You can be kidnapped, or even the killers can enter to the hospitals to finish their job.
We talk to a doctor who is trying to save lives in the middle of a crossfire. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about grief today and new research about grief, new findings that are quite interesting. Responsible for many of those findings is my guest, George Bonanno, who's written The Other Side of Sadness, What the New Science of Bereavement Tells Us About Life After Loss. I'm joined also by Barbara Davis, who specializes in grief and hospice work. She's with Center in the Park, and it's she's doing some research that's been funded by Jefferson University. I want to turn to you, George, and I have a simple question. Who's more likely to be resilient? Who's more likely to get stuck?
Well, that's a great question, and actually it feeds off a little bit the question that was called in just before you took your break. When we traditionally had thought about bereavement as a kind of a long, drawn-out process of work that everybody must slog through, we tended to think that only a very small percentage of people, a rare type of person, would be resilient. In other words, that they would be able to take the hit, or take the pain, and keep going, keep functioning. We now know that most people, as our research has shown, that most people, even though they suffer, even though they feel the pangs of grief, even pretty much early on, they can still function. They can still interact with other people and concentrate and keep going.
All right, wait a minute. I got to stop you there.
Okay.
You're the researcher.
Yes.
What do you mean most people?
More than 50% of all bereaved people, say 55%, 60%.
Okay.
The majority of bereaved people.
Okay.
And this is what we've seen in study after study using large epidemiological samples and small studies where we've interviewed people. We see it often enough. Now, it doesn't mean, I should clarify, that I'm not saying that people just grieve a little bit and they're done. What I'm saying is that people feel the pain of grief, they struggle with it, but they go in and out of that state, as I mentioned before, and they can keep functioning within a few days or however time they want to take off. Then they're able to go to work or able to be around the people they love. They're able to deliver an address at a funeral or a eulogy. You know, they can do those kind of things to keep functioning. The pain still is there, but it comes and goes. And
so I want to pick up on a question I see on my screen. We've got a caller named Mark, who wants to know, is there closure after death? Apparently he's experienced a violent death of a loved one. Well, what about this business of closure?
Well, I don't think there's closure in life. So I don't think there's closure after death either. Closure is one of those sort of pop psychology word that just floats around out there, and we talk about, you know, grieving someone and getting closure. We don't have closure when people are alive, because relationships and human beings are very complicated. We're multifaceted. So when a person dies, we still continue to think about them in multifaceted ways.
I'd had a experience, you know, I've referred to my sister now twice, but a year after she died, I wanted to ask various religious leaders about where she is now, according to their religious beliefs. And to be honest, I don't remember most of what I learned, but I had an experience with a Buddhist teacher who also lost his brother. And he said to me, when my brother was alive, he was alive for me in 100 different ways. He said, now he's alive for me in 99 different ways. And I thought that was quite telling, which you know, I wonder about your dad. Where is he for you?
It's an impossible question to answer. And at different times, a person is in different places and in different experiences. I think it's impossible to really, it's almost impossible to rule out possibilities, because we simply don't know. I tell the story in my book of an older woman who was my neighbor, and she was, I believe, 99 at the time, and it was clear that she wasn't going to live much longer, but she was incredibly sharp mentally. And she said to me one day, soon I will know something nobody else knows. Soon I will know what happens when we die. And the truth is, we just simply don't know. So we content ourselves with whatever explanation we want to provide for ourselves. Mm. And I think the explanation your Buddhist friend gave you is one of the best explanations possible, which is there are just many different ways. There are many different possibilities for where a person is, or what we might experience, or if the person is anywhere at all.
Yeah. Let's see if we can get another call on. We've got Jen on line one. Jen, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I basically had a question about grieving and everything. Being as though death is a part of life, as everyone knows, how could we teach the next generation how to better cope with it? Like, you know, everything comes to life in stages, and it's just a normal thing. And that, even though it's rare, we don't know where we go afterwards, it is a normal thing. So, like, how could we, I guess, better prepare, you know, our younger sisters or little cousins or whatever for, you know, that stage in life.
What a great
that's eventually going to happen.
What a great question, and what a loving and generous question, Barbara.
Well, I think by normalizing that everything has a beginning and an end, and with young children, I think pets are oftentimes the first being that they see die. And, you know, I've seen families have all kinds of rituals for what happens when a pet dies, rather than kind of whisking it off to someplace that the kids don't know. You know, there are all kinds of burial rituals that people go through with pets who die. So I think, you know, normalizing the fact that, you know, just as we live, we will die.
Yeah.
And not preventing kids from understanding and from being part of you know, the mourning rituals that go on.
And I would also think for to partly answer Jen's question and many others, even normalizing sadness.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, often we either want to, you know, shut sadness off or pathologize it, and that's
right.
The message we get.
Right.
George, do you want to weigh in on that? What can we do for the next generation to help them
de-pathologize? Yeah, well, I completely agree with what Barbara Davis had just said, and I thought that was quite beautifully put. And I also agree with your statement just before about normalizing sadness. That sadness is part of what we can expect in life, and that people, things do begin and things do end, and sadness is what we often feel. You know, I think that's just all completely right on the money. You know, I think that we tend to transmit to our children our belief systems one way or another. So if we have profound religious beliefs, we'll probably urge our children to think along those lines. But increasingly, kids are growing up, and I don't know if this was the roots of Jen's question, that children are growing up in a much more multicultural, multi belief system world, where they're getting the idea that people have different understandings of life and death and the important episodes in life. And so that, you know, we are free in a sense to make up our minds for ourselves how we explain those things.
Do you think, and I'll turn to you, Barbara, do you think that how we understand the afterlife affects how we grieve? Or George?
I think that for some people, it does. But, you know, I've worked with enough people who would call themselves, you know, Catholic or Jewish, or for whom religion does not provide the comfort after death that they thought it was going to.
George, is there any research on this?
There is relatively little. Again, some of the studies we've done in China, comparing China and the United States, where we've explicitly looked at people's beliefs about continuing relationships, but in one of the things we've seen is that when people are confronted with the big loss, with a loss that really throws them, or one that they really are going to worry about, or, you know, a loss of someone extremely important to them, sometimes whatever beliefs they came into the event with don't really mean that much, because they now have a new situation to contend with. And sometimes it's beyond people's beliefs even. They may have a sense of, I'm sensing this person's presence, and I didn't anticipate that. And that can be scary at times, too. There's a whole lot of mixes there.
I'm learning a lot of things from this show that we have to conclude right now. I'm learning that people are more resilient than we mental health professionals ever knew, that people tend to get over it, the majority, tend to get through it more quickly. And the other thing I'm learning with all the questions I've asked you, George, about is there any research to support this, and you say no. One of the things I'm hearing is you've got a lot of work ahead of you, fella. You've got a lot of work. So I hope you're young and have a ton of money, because get busy, and we'll have you on next year. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for joining us, to both of you. My guests have been George Bonanno, Chair of the Department of Counseling and Clinical Psychology at Teachers College, author of The Other Side of Sadness. Barbara Davis has joined me here in the studio. She is a local bereavement counselor. Next week, we're going to be talking about technology and how it affects our brains. You can reach us at voices@whyy.org. You can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been John Knapp. Excuse me, Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Gita Simons and Stephanie Marutis produce the show. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week.